Elvis.
About a Girl is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. Let me tell you about Mick Jagger, the archetype of a rock and roll frontman, singer, songwriter, shapeshifter, style icon, and the man who kept the Rolling Stones going into their seventh decade. But this is not about Mick. This is about Marianne Faithfull, the singer who became a symbol of swinging London, who inspired some of Mick's most beloved songs, but who suffered a crisis of identity before dropping out of her life entirely, only to find her true voice and emerge as a dynamic artist. This story is about a girl. What am I gonna do? Mick Jagger was crying. What in hell am I gonna do? The Rolling Stones frontman was looking out from his prison cell at his girlfriend, beside himself, in a panic. Marianne Faithfull was also distraught, feeling helpless. Not knowing what else to do, she slipped into an icy maternal mode. No bullshit. God, Mick, pull yourself together. What are these cops gonna think of you when they see you falling apart like this? She wanted to help him protect himself, but when she heard herself, she regretted it. She felt responsible for Mick's predicament. After all, it was her stash of amphetamines that put him here. Marianne first met Mick at a party in 1964. They barely spoke. She was with her future husband, the artist and poet John Dunbar, who would soon become as much a central figure in the so-called swinging London scene as Marianne, a bonding agent between British aristocrats and working-class pop stars. He would later introduce John Lennon to Yoko Ono at his gallery. The connection made at this party was between Marianne and the Rolling Stones' Machiavellian manager, Andrew Loog Oldham. He approached Dunbar and began asking him about Marianne as though she were not sitting right there beside him. Who is she? Can she act? What's her name? She's called Marianne Faithfull, actually. Oh, do come on, darling. You'll have to do better than that. It really is her name. Can she sing? I think she can. Why the hell not? You can sing, can't you, Marianne? Asked later how he came to discover Marianne, Oldham would say, I saw an angel with big tits and signed her. Marianne was indeed powerfully beautiful. Almond-shaped blue eyes, pristine complexion, voluminous straight blonde hair, casually yet perfectly fringed and framing her face. She was just 17. There's not much more of a fuss about how she got started than that. Andrew Oldham was a man of great drive and ambition. He'd instructed Mick and his Stones partner, Keith Richards, to write a song, and they produced As Time Goes By, which Andrew changed to As Tears Go By, and which Marianne recorded just a week later. The song was designed to match the image Oldham was creating for her, based on his own brief impressions and commercial potential. This portrait of her as a romantic ideal, with an air of vague nobility, but laid low by some profound loss, was not altogether fantastical. Marianne's mother was, in fact, a baroness from an Austro-Hungarian lineage. But with time and the devastation of World War II, all the baroness had left was her title. Oldham did all he could to capitalize on this alluring mix of aristo and bohemian that would come to characterize swinging London. As Tears Go By was a hit, and so Marianne stumbled into life as a pop star, with the attendant touring, recording sessions, television appearances, photo shoots, and interviews. As a performer and interviewee, she was impenetrable. She would stand, radiant, at the microphone on stage and conjure up the nerve from her stillness, her focus somewhere deep inside herself. In her interviews, she would invent personas, obtuse, irreverent, abstract, pretentious. She'd say whatever wild shit occurred to her, like, I believe in living on several different planes at once. It's terribly important, don't you think? In reality, she was actively passive in the aesthetic of the English Romantic poets, her great passion. As she had with Oldham entering her life, Marianne left herself to fate and allowed it to take her wherever it might. She had numerous affairs, a lesbian relationship, and one-night stands with Alan Clark of the Hollies, Jane Pitney, and the Jeremy half of Chad and Jeremy. She took on adventures wherever she could find them. It was a dangerous existence at far too young an age, but she was in the zeitgeist, ground zero, London, the mid-1960s. John Dunbar had gone to Greece for a few months before Marianne's record was released. He returned to find his girlfriend a pop music star, something he tolerated in principle and embraced financially. She became pregnant with his child, a son, Nicholas, in April of 1965, and they were married a month later. Marianne and John got on very well, but they were quickly swept onto different paths in the cultural cauldron coming to a boil around them. By 1966, Dunbar was striving for the upper-class, boho, mash-up life. Gifted artists, poets, intellectuals, and peers of the British Empire, none of them really working, all getting high on methadrine, morphine, cocaine, and pharmaceutical heroin at the Dunbar Faithful Flat. Marianne would prepare her son's bottle next to a draining board strewn with used needles. She grew frustrated with her role in this scene. I had been badly miscast as mother, angel, girlfriend, wife, and blessed Virgin Mary, she reflected later. Marianne could sense the electric atmosphere of London outside her window, and so she began fleeing the flat into her fateful life as part of the Rolling Stones' inner circle, first as a consort of Stones' multi-instrumentalist Brian Jones and his girlfriend Anita Pallenberg. The tragic Jones was already on his descent, being edged out from the band he'd founded, helpless to battle his many demons, frail and seeming to fade before their eyes. Anita, in contrast, was an incredible life force, dazzling and dangerous, drawing Marianne toward her, a friendship that would last through many highs and lows. In the mode of the era, Anita would go on to have an affair with Mick Jagger and a 13-year relationship and three children with Keith Richards. It was at Brian and Anita's that the swinging London picture came into view. This was a meeting place of the gilded set, pop celebrities and the children of British nobility, each fantasizing themselves into the other. Young and wealthy, drunk on fame, music, sex, and of course high on drugs. Here, Marianne could continue her life as a child, yielding her life to an unseen destiny. Drug experimentation was a central element, and Marianne took to it quickly, having bizarrely been discouraged from it in the drug den where she lived. LSD was part of the atmosphere at Brian and Anita's, and there were endless trips. Mind expansion. Largely absent from this scene was Mick Jagger. It was more Keith's bag in the time before he and Mick formed their permanent alliance. Marianne was drawn to the naturally cool Keith, the epitome of a romantic hero, defiant and tormented. But he was already in love with Anita. Mick would drop in as an observer. He smoked hash and would take acid, but always kept it contained. He had the songwriter's eye, and the people around him, in their various states of uninhibition, were fodder for some of the most celebrated songs of the rock era. While everyone else indulged their impulses, the ever-grounded and organized Jagger channeled it into his art. As with generations of fans since, it was watching Mick perform, especially in those frenzied early days of rock and roll fanaticism, that opened Marianne's eyes to his charismatic aura. But what sealed the deal for her was his intellectualism, his knowledge of history and literature, and his philosophical approach to art, film, and music. She quizzed him one night with questions about King Arthur, the Druids, and Stonehenge. He knew he was being tested, but was game for it, and he passed. There was a potent psychic connection between them. That night, they went to bed together for the first time. She did have one night with Keith in those early days, and she felt herself falling for him, but he quickly dissuaded her. You know who really has it bad for you, don't you? Oh no, darling, who's that? Mick, didn't you know? Go on, love, give him a jingle, he'll fall off his chair. He's not that bad when you get to know him, you know. The brush off. She was hurt, but she thought it was for the best. She felt not quite up to Keith's level, not like Anita, and she knew that Mick was much safer for her. In Mick, she found an exit door from the life she was beginning to loathe. She was done with John Dunbar's boys club bullshit, and she had soured on the singing career she'd wandered into backwards. They had a great time together, shopping, traveling, talking. They dropped acid and played their favorite music for each other. Mick was protective of her. He may have even bought into the Oldham concocted image of her and believed she needed rescuing. And maybe she did. Marianne was still drifting with the wind. But it was this protective instinct that landed Mick Jagger in prison. By 1967, people like the Stones and the Beatles were openly advocating drug use and its potential to change society for the better. None more so than Marianne, with her pre-existing penchant for saying shocking and literally half-baked things to interviewers. They carelessly waged war on the establishment, the old empire, an ancient force now planning a counterattack. The stuffy old prigs would simply discredit these degenerates and color them as extremists whose behavior is so shocking as to put a quiver into many a stiff upper lip. Stories were cooked up with the willing old guard press to marginalize them. And then came the coup de grace. Word went around the Stone Circle that a guy was coming in from California with blotters of supposedly top-shelf acid. Primo shit. White lightning. They heard it from Robert Fraser, designer of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper cover, trendsetter, friend to the stars, and art dealer. His gallery had previously been invaded by Metro Police, intent on clamping down supposedly indecent art. That had been another warning shot, but at this point, none of the swinging glitterati were seriously concerned about a bunch of old mustaches and their manufactured morality, so all signs of trouble went unheeded. Fraser called Marianne to tell her about this guy with the acid. How fucking great! Wait, Robert, I've got a fantastic idea. Why don't we all go down to Redlands for the weekend? I'll call Keith right now and set it up. What's this guy's name again? David Schneiderman, the Acid King, flew in this morning. Well, don't let him get away. Redlands is Keith Richards' estate about 2 hours outside of London, remote and peaceful. The perfect place to traverse the cosmos with a few of your comrades. So after a recording session one night in February, they all piled into a van and drove out to Sussex. Marianne, Mick, Keith, Fraser, Schneiderman, and a handful of others. First thing the next morning, they turned on with a cup of tea and the strongest acid they'd ever had. They headed out in the van, eventually ending up at the beach. Marianne was having a tip-top trip, and it seemed that everyone else was on the same wavelength. Tired and dirty from their adventure and beginning to come down from the acid, they headed back to Redlands. Everyone cleaned up and changed. Marianne had neglected to bring a change of clothes, so after her bath, she pulled a giant fur floor covering around her and everyone settled in to chill together as evening fell. Then the cops walked in. Were welcomed in, actually, with their search warrant. Instead of reacting with fear and worry, the day trippers mocked the cops, cracking each other up. As the search of the house began, Keith went to the turntable and put on Dylan's Rainy Day Woman, as in, everybody must get stoned. As they laughed, the cops became more incensed. A female constable was tasked with searching Marianne. As she was wearing only a rug, this seemed especially absurd. So she flipped open the fur and did a little curtsy to cheekily demonstrate the futility of such a search. While they would find nothing on Marianne but her new fur, they did not come up quite so empty as they scoured the house. Firstly, unbeknownst to his friends, Robert Fraser was already a heroin addict, and they found his stash. Second, they came upon a handful of motion sickness pills containing speed, purchased legally in Italy by Marianne and long forgotten in the pocket of a velvet coat. Mick jumped forward to claim them as his. Schneiderman and his case full of LSD, meanwhile, went curiously unmolested. It didn't take too long to realize they had been set up and that this mysterious American was the government's stooge. After the bust, he was nowhere to be found. Mick, Keith, and Robert Frazier were all charged and released on bail. Frazier and Mick were convicted on day one of their trials and sent to Lewes Jail to await sentencing. Marianne had protested vehemently that she should testify. "But they're my pills. Why don't I get up on the stand and just say they're mine? I'll go. I'll take the blame." Mick and his barrister agreed that this was out of the question. The lone young woman at this party of deviants with a history of mouthing off in the press, the prosecution would eat her alive. What they didn't consider was that Marianne was going to be roasted no matter what. She became a key character in the prosecution's case. The part of the woman will be shamefully played by Miss Marianne Faithful. In this recounting, she was a harlot, a slut, immoral, and worst of all, had no respect for the law or society's norms. "The woman," testified the female constable, "was in a merry mood and one of vague unconcern." Marianne wasn't even allowed to get up and defend herself. The press tore her up, courtesy of their sources in the Metropolitan Police, who, free of the inconvenient constraints of testifying under oath, painted the Redland scene as some kind of twisted orgy. Most appallingly, they'd floated a rumor that police had walked in on a scene of Mick eating a Mars bar out of Marianne's vagina. The kind of rumor so salacious that it's impossible to undo, an early version of the urban legend. "It was far too jaded for any of us to have even conceived of," she would recall. "It's a dirty old man's fantasy, a cop's idea of what people do on acid." The bust accelerated the sad decline of Robert Frazier, whose jacks of heroin earned him 6 months hard labor. He was never the same after that. Mick received 3 months and Keith got a year since it all happened at his property. During the course of the trial, Brian Jones was also raided, with the press alerted in advance. It was a conspiracy and no one was laughing anymore. Finally, the Times of London ran an editorial denouncing this clear persecution, highlighting the flimsiness of the case against Mick and Keith. The tide of public opinion, always the intended jury, turned quickly in their favor. Mick's sentence was suspended on appeal, and Keith's conviction overturned completely. Far from marginalized, the Stones were now folk heroes, well on their way to legendary status. They had been elevated as a cultural force by the very forces that had sought to ruin them. And Marianne? Well, she was still just a whore. Despised. The image of her that had been so vividly painted in this sorry chapter would stick through decades. The woman, a sacrifice. A typical piece of hate mail she received read, "The sooner you leave this island with your long blonde hair floating in the sea, it will be a cleaner place." Brian Jones was dead to begin with. It was 1969 and Brian had drowned in his swimming pool, just months after being fired from his band. Yet, how odd, Marianne thought. There he was again on the street, way down below the Australian hotel room where she was staying with Mick as they were both scheduled to shoot the film Ned Kelly. The room was sky high, and so was Marianne. She'd first recognized the sickly, pale, doomed face of poor Brian when she'd woken up in the hotel room after a long flight and looked into the mirror. She'd cut her hair recently, was anorexic and unhealthy, and had popped more than a dozen downers on the plane. Disoriented, she did not know where or even who she was. She looked like Brian, so she must be Brian. And Brian, she knew, was dead. She figured she'd better take the rest of those pills and get on with it. As she looked down at her deceased friend on the street, he began to expand upward toward her, beckoning. She emerged into a strange land and walked with Brian as they chatted. He had been lonely and confused, so he called for her, a friend. Brian didn't seem to know he was dead. Marianne wasn't sure about herself. She looked at the crumbling world around her and considered that this might be hell. Brian was weeping now, and she tried to distract him. But then he turned to her, suddenly cheerful. "Welcome to death," he proclaimed. A cliff loomed ahead, and Brian walked to the edge. "Coming?" he asked, and then stepped into the abyss. Voices called to her, but she was not ready to go. She roamed around for a long while. She was in an airport where strangers would stop and ask if she was lost. "I'm waiting for Mick to come and get me," she told them. And he did. 6 days later, she woke up. Mick had found her unconscious and got her to the hospital. He was devastated that she'd been in so much pain. Despite her delirium and hallucinations, her Australian journey to the other side had no doubt been a serious suicide attempt. When her mind cleared, she remembered that she had known what she was doing all along. Marianne's role in the film was recast, but Mick continued shooting, writing her letters from set each day, doing his best to care for her. But she couldn't even put into words the psychic wounds she sustained from her demonization after the Redlands bust and from the death of Brian, which no one else seemed especially worked up about. Eventually, she drove Mick further from her. No one wanted to hear about her walk with Brian. In actuality, they were all quietly devastated by his death, perhaps not because they had particular affection for him, but because they were so young and he'd been one of them, for better or worse. And none of them were really equipped to confront the strange case of their beautiful Marianne, growing distant, tormented. She, Keith, and Anita were all using heroin by then. They spent some time in America as the Stones finished their album, Let It Bleed. Marianne continued to self-destruct, in part because she wanted to push Mick, make him hate her. She didn't have the courage to leave, so she tried to make him do it. They were part of the same identity. His. Mick plus Marianne still added up to Mick. Charming and kind, beautiful and celebrated. But Marianne hated her own beauty, the meaningless facade of it. She hated herself in this picture, so she scratched herself out of it. The Stones moved to France and began working on Exile on Main Street. Marianne packed up a few things from the flat she shared with Mick, took her son, and moved in with her mother, who lived in a cottage Mick had bought her. Mick was bewildered, but she'd succeeded in alienating him. It was over. She zoned out, became even more passive than before, shed her personality. Her mother took over and cared for Nicholas. Marianne got engaged to a man she'd met while she was still with Mick. A good man, but he was little more than a ride out of that relationship. The next guy was a young, beautiful French aristo and straight scumbag, John de Breteuil, a fellow dope fiend she met through Keith. One weekend, they went to Paris together. There, he got a call from Jim Morrison's girlfriend, Pamela, whom Jean had dated, and he suddenly had to go out. Marianne wanted him to take her to meet Morrison, but he refused. When he returned, he beat the shit out of her. "So," she said, lighting a smoke, "did you have a good time over there? Aren't you gonna tell me why you're in such a good mood?" "Get packed," he scolded her. Jim Morrison was dead, and John had provided the fatal smack. He would OD himself just a few months later. That was it for Marianne. She dropped out and began something of a lost decade. But she wasn't really lost. She was in Soho, now a full-blown heroin addict, sitting all day on the wall of a burned-out building wrecked by German bombers. She still wore the glamorous clothes of her former self, but otherwise went fully anonymous, scoring drugs and living the life of a street junkie, with occasional visits to her mother's cottage. Her ex-husband gained custody of their son. There was some romance to it, she supposed. Kind of a William Burroughs trip. Anyway, it wasn't as though the life she abandoned had been fulfilling. And on the street, people were kind to her. No one cared about what she'd done, the media coverage, who she'd slept with. There was no old life to go back to in any case. The end of the 60s, Altamont, the deaths of so many friends and icons, and then Charles Manson, Nixon paranoia, Cambodia, and Kent State. The Stones were in France. Everyone was scattered. And London was just London. No more swinging. Marianne was 23 years old. Marianne Faithfull came back to life slowly and with several false starts. She had subsisted on the kindness of her fellow street denizens and royalties earned from the song she'd written with Mick, Sister Morphine, which she'd released as a single years earlier, but was then recorded by the Stones for their Sticky Fingers album. An old producer of hers tracked her down and they recorded a new album, but it was shelved. In 1974, she sang a duet with David Bowie on his television special. Inspired by Bowie and his way of creating characters to more easily express himself, Marianne began writing music again. Then she had a hit with the single Dreaming My Dreams, which went to number one in Ireland. This success resulted in a few more opportunities, appearances, tours, and recordings, but she was never settled. Always with one foot back on the streets of Soho and always looking for a fix. In 1976, she met Ben Brierley, who would become her second husband. He was a musician and an addict too, but they managed together to find places to live and were happy. They rubbed elbows with the emerging punk rock scene, and Marianne absorbed the energy that she could no longer find in the music and bands of her youth. She and Sid Vicious even had the same dealer. She was working with a band on the songs that would become Broken English, an incredibly forward-thinking album that melded Marianne's poetic sensibility, the shattered rawness of her life, the wired intensity of punk, synthy grooves of disco, and off-kilter guitars of new wave. Chris Blackwell of Island Records loved it and released it in November 1979. It was a critical and commercial hit. The world had written off Marianne, or more accurately, she had written herself out of the world, and everyone was pleasantly surprised to hear her again. Her voice a full octave lower than it had been in the 60s, worn and lived in, singing urgent songs of anger, jealousy, and death with a gravitas no one had ever suspected was in her. This was her masterpiece. To Marianne, the artistic fulfillment of Broken English was a validation. The image of her all these years had been an empty shell, a beautiful veneer that had little to do with her. A new and electrifying person had emerged, damaged and dangerous and magnetic. The album went platinum and was nominated for a Grammy. They moved to New York, but Ben was eventually deported after a bust while Marianne was away, and the relationship, pure drug codependency by then, was finally put down. In 1985, after a lengthy spiral, she was admitted to Hazelden Clinic in Minneapolis, where she cleaned up for good. At Hazelden, she met a deeply damaged schizophrenic addict named Howard and became infatuated. Marianne was thriving there, but Howard hated it and bailed, escaping to Boston. When Marianne left the program, she went to meet him. But Howard was not well, truly on the edge. After a few weeks, he jumped to his death from their apartment window in Boston's Harbor Towers. Marianne was haunted by his suicide, with echoes of Brian Jones. The full weight of her past traumas, sedated away for so long, came down on her all at once. A delayed post-traumatic stress that she had to finally confront. It was the tragic final step of her detox. Howard's death knocked her into a reality she felt she had hardly ever known. No more games to win now, no clever moves, no Mick to protect her, no self-medication. Just the hard work of living in the world as a grown-up. There was no inevitable destiny, she realized. the future had to be forged. She was alive, and at last emerged from the darkest of shadows. In 1987, Marianne made Strange Weather, an album of interpretations of standards and other covers dedicated to Howard. It included a new recording of her first single, As Tears Go By, imbued with the battered grit and grief it had always called for. Though the fire of broken English was gone, it was replaced by an equally compelling hard-earned wisdom, and the album established her as a smoldering chanteuse and a premier artist. She went on to record some of the best work of her life, the rare 60s icon who continues to improve with age. She worked with fans like Beck, Blur, Nick Cave, and PJ Harvey, and friends like Van Morrison, and of course, Keith Richards. Marianne became a grandmother and moved to Ireland, a country that had always embraced her. In 2020, she contracted the COVID-19 virus, and her future as a singer was put into question. But she responded with a new album of readings of uplifting poems by Byron, Keats, and Shelley, ever the romantic, over soundscapes by her longtime collaborator Warren Ellis, as well as Brian Eno and Nick Cave. She kept up with some of her old friends, including Mick, and maintained a strong bond with Keith. "I feel," she wrote of Keith, "when I'm with him, as if we are the last remaining compatriots of a long-vanished kingdom who have not entirely renounced the old ways. I may be the revamped, recovered, rehabilitated Marianne, but I'm still as flummoxed as ever about things. And Keith is always ready to give me quick crash courses on how to cope. He's very good at this." But this isn't about Keith or Mick or Anita or Brian. This is about Marianne Faithfull, a survivor who dropped out of her glittering life, who fed her innocence to experience and surfaced again, walking in beauty, never letting the buggers grind her down. This is about a girl. About a Girl comes to you from Double Elvis and is executive produced by Jake Brennan and Brady Sadler. It was created by Eleanor Wells. Scott Janovitz is the show's producer and composer. Matt Bowden provides logistical support. I'm Nikki Lynette. Thanks for listening. You can follow me at Nikki Lynette on Twitter and Instagram, at Double Elvis on Instagram, and at Double Elvis FM on Twitter. If you like the show, please be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more great podcasts from Double Elvis, visit doubleelvis.com.